history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that need to be heard. Sometimes all it takes is for us to ask a few questions and be willing to listen. And we are more than ready to do that today with 94-year-old Henry Oshner of California City, California. Not the biggest place in the world. The sign coming in says 13,000 people. Out in the Mojave Desert, but the Oshners have lived here for quite a while. He and Violet recently celebrated their 70th anniversary. But I got to get the name straight, though. Every article I read about you says Henry, but you go by Leonard.
Well, Henry Leonard is the way it goes.
Uh-huh.
And my mother always said, but the name was Leonard Henry. But my birth certificate says Henry Leonard. But usually for business, like when we worked for Hughes Aircraft and stuff like that.
Yeah.
We worked on the Trident and Polaris and everything like that.
Yeah.
My name was always Henry, but my friends started calling me Len, so I just let it go, you know. So that
Len sounds good enough for me. And, of course, the purpose of this program is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, boy, do we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Mr. Oshner is 94 years old. He served in one of the most well-known units of World War II. Maybe you were a fan of the TV series Band of Brothers. Maybe you've read books about that. But Easy Company of the 506th Parachute Infantry Regiment, part of the 101st Airborne, the Screamin' Eagles. We're going to hear about that, but that's not how it started out with your military story.
Easy Company is Band of Brothers.
Exactly. But that's not where you started out. And let's go way back. So you are the son of a World War I veteran.
Yes, uh-huh.
What did your father do in World War I?
He was infantry.
Did he tell you much about it?
No, not a word.
Was that something you always kind of found interesting, though, seeing his uniform and all?
No, it was before I was born.
Uh-huh. And did you have brothers and sisters growing up?
Three sisters and myself.
And tell us where you grew up.
In Missoula, Montana. And I was born in a little town north of Missoula called Hell's Gate.
Uh-huh.
And I was born and raised there. And then we moved to Missoula, Montana. In the fall, I would go down and visit with my cousins because we had haying to do.
Mm.
So we always got the hay in, you know.
Well, do you remember, I know this is a long time ago, I'm asking you to go back 80, 85 years here, but do you remember as a boy having some ideas? Hey, when I grow up, I'm going to do this and this and this. Did you have
I have no recollection of that at all.
Uh-huh. Just too busy getting work done?
Too busy trying to live.
Uh-huh. Was the Great Depression really felt there in Missoula?
I think it was, yeah. Uh-huh. We had enough to eat and everything, you know, but there's some people didn't.
And you are aware of that?
Yes, uh-huh.
I don't want to miss anything in between, and feel free to insert, but one question I like to ask everybody, because it seems like everybody remembers something, but December 7th, 1941, do you remember where you were and how you found out about Pearl Harbor?
I was living in Youngstown, a little district in Seattle. I was driving my car, had the car radio on, and they said that the Japanese had been bombing Pearl Harbor. I pulled over and listened to it, you know. But it was pretty awful, I think.
Yeah, probably kind of hard to believe or hard to understand.
Yeah.
And did it occur to you then, or was it a while before you realized that you were going to end up part of this?
I really didn't think I was. You know, it didn't bother me. They started a draft.
Mm-hmm.
And I signed up for that. You had to.
Mm-hmm.
I was drafted the late part of 42. They took me in.
Mm-hmm.
And I signed the papers in July of 43. Went downtown. They give you all this medical examinations and everything to see if you're going to be worthy to fight for them, you know. I passed it all. They said, go home. We'll notify you. And it wasn't a week, 2 weeks. They said, report down to the King Street train station. We have a troop train for you to board and go to your training. I did that. They went right down to Camp Roberts. We all got off, and they marched us across the tracks over into Camp Roberts.
Paso Robles, California.
Uh-huh. I'd been to Oregon and Montana, Idaho, mm-hmm. and places like that, but I hadn't been to California.
And were you prepared for what the Army was going to do to you or try to get you to do?
No, I had no idea what was going to happen. They lined us up out there after we were there about a week, 2 weeks, something like that. They asked for volunteers to know how to drive a truck.
Mm-hmm.
I said, here I am. Guess what they gave me? A wheelbarrow.
Not exactly the same.
Nope.
Was it hard to adjust to Army life?
Not really. You just go with the flow. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
They tell you what to do and you do it. But I never volunteered again.
Well, that's not what I heard. I've heard about some other things you volunteered for. But I want to ask you, one of the things they told you to do, and I've had a lot of veterans share with me about this, and people today say, really, they did that? But you guys would have to crawl under barbed wire or under a hail of bullets, live bullets
live
going over your head.
30 caliber machine gun.
That's enough to kill you if you pop your head
up.
Easily. And I've never talked to anybody who actually got hit. You're showing me on your right leg. You still have a scar.
My left leg.
I don't know my right from my left. Your left leg, I can see the scar right there. But that happened in training at Camp Roberts?
Yeah. We was going through the infiltration course, and you're on your belly, and I got my M1. At that time, I had a carbine because they put me in the field artillery, and I'm crawling along under this barbed wire. The barbed wire is that far off the ground.
Right, just a couple feet.
And
just
it's intertwined over an area just bigger than this house.
Uh-huh.
And you crawl there, and you go through it, all the way across it. And if you get across it, you've done past that part. Then, of course, you do the rest of the training. But I'm crawling along there, and I had never in my life seen a big spider. So I'm crawling along, and I stopped. I saw this spider. He must have been at least 6 inches across.
Big hairy tarantula?
Uh-huh.
Woo!
And I'd never seen a spider that big. So I looked at him, and he's sitting there. I turned to the right a little bit, and it seemed he turned to the right a little, to his left a little bit. I said, no. So I went back, and he turned and he looked at me again. I went this way, and he looked at it again. I said, oh, the hell with it, and I stood up. That's when the bullet hit me. He'd only had a chance to fire one shell. He'd let loose as a butterfly to keep from killing me, you know, to chopping me in half. So they took me to the hospital. They got me all well, and they said, we're not putting you back in the field artillery. We're giving you infantry because you done goofed it all up. So it's probably a good thing that it happened that way, because the field artillery outfit that I was with, they sent them to the South Pacific. And, of course, when I finished my basic training there, they sent me to Fort Meade, Maryland.
Right.
That's between Baltimore and Washington. We was there about a week, 2 weeks, something like that. And then they put us on ships to go over to England. I was on a ship called the Thomas F. Hunt. I was on a forward deck, and some guy come up to me, and he says, your name, Oshner? I said, yeah. He says, so is mine. Come on, we'll have dinner. So from then on, for the rest of the voyage, I ate with the crew.
Nice.
I had good food, you know. I didn't have GI food.
Oh, it's all in the name, I guess. Hey, I've got to ask you about getting hit in training. And you pointed out, if that guy doesn't react quickly enough on the machine gun, he could have sawed you in half.
Could have cut me out.
Sure. Have you ever seen a spider like that again in all these years?
Oh, yeah. I've seen a lot of them since then because I live down here now, you know.
Out here in the desert, they do get a few. Yeah. In
fact, Camp Roberts had a lot of them, because if you go out west of it there, we used to go out on field trips where we'd put on our full pack and a rifle, and you march out about 8 miles or something like that, and then you camp for the night and then come back the next day.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at night, the spiders like something warm, so they would crawl alongside of your sleeping bag to keep warm, you know?
No, thank you.
After that, it didn't bother me, you know. After.
Well, and at least they were big enough you could use them for target practice, right?
No, I never bothered with them. I couldn't see killing them.
Yeah, even though they almost got you killed, or that one did. And when you point out what happened to the unit you were with, or where they would have gone, have you heard stories about what that field artillery unit encountered?
I was told by our lieutenant they were selected to go to South Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
But where, I don't know.
But you would have headed out sooner.
I'd have went with them, yeah.
As it was, though, you were involved in the longest day, as well as one of the most infamous battles of World War II in Europe. And you mentioned going over to England. At what point were you told, or is this something you volunteered for, that you were going to be glider infantry?
you don't volunteer for gliders.
Mm-hmm.
You're just like infantry.
Right.
If they want you here, they put you there. So I was put into this glider outfit of the 101st. I was with them for about a month and a half, and then we had to take glider flight to qualify to be a glider man, you know?
Sure.
In the meantime, they would teach you how to take and put a Jeep in one of those gliders and tie it down, just so that when you wanted out, you just started up the Jeep and started driving, and it would raise the front,
mm-hmm.
and you could drive out. And then the ammunition and a little 75-millimeter howitzer, a little small thing.
Right. I've seen all that loaded into a glider, and it's hard to believe that a powerless aircraft can carry all of that in addition to men.
Yeah,
but that's the way they built them.
Plus the crew.
And were you at all nervous about that duty, about being in a glider?
No, it didn't bother me.
Uh-huh.
So anyhow, we're all in this glider. There's nothing in there but us GIs. No ammunition, no guns, no Jeep. It's just us. And we're along the sides. You know, you sit on along the side, and you're facing in on a little bench. And the pilot come in. Is he ready, boys? And he's a little on the tipsy side. So I didn't pay no attention to that. So we're hooked up to a C-47 with a big, long nylon cable. Not a cable. It's a line, a nylon line. And it's about 1.5, 2 inches in diameter. You watch the C-47 take off down the runway, and you're still here. The pilot's got the brakes on. So the tail starts raising up because the line is hooked up to a triangle thing on the top of the glider, just about where the pilot sits.
Right.
And it kind of pulls, and then it kind of raises up the tail. And when it gets to a certain point, this pilot decides that's enough, and he'll release the brakes, and that gives you an extra push to get off the ground. This nylon rope, it gets down to about, I would say, maybe inch and a quarter, 2 inches maybe. Then you go up, and he gets to the right or the left of the 47 to stay out of the prop wash and help the airplane better to get off the ground and everything. Mm-hmm. Doesn't have to go as far that way. And so we're up in the air, and we're being tied to this 47. And there's three gliders hooked to it. There's one below the airplane, and then us, and then another one over here, over to your right. You go around up there for a while, and he watches the other gliders. When they release, he lets them get out of the way, and then he says, okay, here we go down. And he hit the lever, and we got released from the C-47. And we coast around and come down the landing field to begin with where it first starts. It's about a 3-foot bank. The concrete stops right there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about 3 feet high because it was down a little wash. And then, of course, you got the regular runway. But he was on the spoilers. The pilot had done the spoilers, and he was coming in all like that, you know, which slows it down.
Mm-hmm.
He misjudged it. He was about that much too low. The landing gear hit that little concrete abutment there, and off they came. They left. It took off on an angle across, off into the field next to the runway. And there's a bunch of trees over there. And we're going pretty good clip. Out left, we're on the runners now. There's runners underneath of it.
Right.
And he goes between two trees. And just on the other side of the trees, it stopped. He turned around and looked at us. He said, pretty good landing. Pretty good landing. We stepped out the door. There's no wings, no tail. Just a fuselage sitting there. And I said, oh, my God. Maybe next time won't be so lucky. So we was back in our little barracks. We was bivouacked on a farm. We was living in a barn. So about a week after we got back after that flight, this guy came around, this officer, and he says, we need volunteers for the paratroopers. I raised my hand. I said, right here. Because I wasn't going to ride them gliders no more.
Well, and it's pretty amazing. You got shot in training in California. You almost get killed in a crash stateside before you ever go overseas. So were you thinking that something else was going to happen next? I mean, you almost never made it overseas.
You know, I'm surprised that we weren't sunk, because there was hundreds and hundreds of ships that were sunk that the Germans sank. The mm-hmm. submarines sank them.
Sure.
Hundreds of them. And I'm surprised that we made it.
And you mentioned volunteering for paratrooper duty, different from the glider infantry. You're already in the 101st, as you told us. Did you ever come to a point where you regretted that? You wondered what you got yourself into?
No, huh? I more or less enjoyed it.
Enjoyed it?
Oh, I really enjoyed it. I went through jump school there in England.
Uh-huh.
For some reason, I didn't get no set of wings, and I wasn't even notified that I was in it. There was me and about 20 other guys that volunteered to be paratroopers. I was never put on the roster.
Hmm.
So anyhow, I went through the training. I made a bunch of jumps, some for qualifying and some for exhibition for other officers and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
For other officers and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then on June the 4th or the 5th, they put us, they said, okay, get packed, we're leaving. And so they put everything in my duffel bag, and I put on my pack and my gun, and they marched us to this airfield. And here's all these C-47s. And there was a whole bunch of them. I don't know how many. Maybe 100. Who knows? So I was assigned an airplane. I said, you go there, you go here, you go there, you go there. We went in and we sat down. And as a bench along the inside on both sides of the airplane, you just sat down. You didn't really hook up yet until he tells you to hook up. We're sitting there, and then pretty soon he says, okay, hook up. I guess they were deciding when we were going to go. They didn't know. There's bad weather here, bad weather there. Then they took off, and we went over the channel and got over to France.
And so began the longest day, D-Day, June 6, 1944, for Len Ochsner. It's break time, but when we come back, where Mr. Ochsner landed with the 506 Parachute Infantry Regiment and the simple but powerful lesson he learned shortly thereafter. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 94-year-old Henry Len Ochsner of California City, California, where he and his wife of 70 years, Violet, settled after retiring from Hughes Aircraft, where they both worked on missile guidance systems. Len's going to take us back now to the early morning hours of June 6th, 1944. With other 101st Airborne paratroopers, he was in a C-47 that flew over the English Channel, preparing to drop into the deep, dark night over France.
And the jump master says, okay, we can have one more cigarette, and that's it. He goes ahead, light up. So everybody's lighting up their cigarettes, and this guy next to me over here on my right, he takes out his pack, puts a cigarette in his mouth. This guy over here had already lit mine and his, and he held his lighter over to my buddy over here. He said, light. The man said, no, I never light. I never have three cigarettes on a match. And he said, oh, okay. So he put it away. And the guy across the had just lit up his lighter. So he went over there and got a light. While he got up, went over there, a shell came up right where he had been sitting. And it was right next to me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
About like here, there was a hole. About that big around.
Bigger than a quarter, like a half-dollar size hole within a foot of you.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And so he looked at that and he said, well, I told you, no three cigarettes on a match. He said, that's bad luck.
Well, and you can laugh about it now, but I just want everybody to understand this situation. This is the middle of the night. I mean, these are the early hours of the morning.
Real early, you know. It's still dark.
Still dark. And you are flying over France, German-held territory in France. You're going inland. As those troops are getting ready to hit the beaches, you're going a lot further. And you're going to jump out of that airplane and try to figure out where in the world you are and fight your way out of it.
I heard, I don't know how true it is, I heard that the pilots were flying any direction they could to see if they could miss all this flak that was coming up from the Germans.
Because nobody really ended up where they were supposed to be.
Very few did.
Yeah.
Well, I landed a mile, maybe, I don't know, someplace in there, from St. Mary Eglise.
Mm-hmm.
We were supposed to drop around Carrington, which is maybe about 30 miles that way.
Right.
And a bunch of us on our ship and about two or three other ships landed just about in the same area. Well, we all gathered in together. And we had 82nd Airborne with us. They had jumped and got jumped in the same place, you know. And they were supposed to be dropped somewhere else, too.
Uh-huh.
But on account of the pilots not knowing where they were, they just gave the green light and said, go.
Well, and what did that feel like? I mean, you're 21 years old. You never made a combat jump before.
No.
You probably don't even know these guys very well that you're jumping with, right?
No, you don't.
And you don't know what's waiting for you down below.
No.
So what was that like, floating down in that parachute from that C-47 under...
You're just hoping that you don't get killed on the way down.
Uh-huh.
Because some of them did.
Yeah.
The Germans were shooting at us from with their rifles, you know.
So you mentioned once you touched down and you see all these other guys that you guys all kind of huddled up. How did that unfold? Was there somebody that took charge that tried to help you know what to do?
There was a captain and a lieutenant, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of officers. And we all got together. He got us together. And he says, we're a little ways from Carrington, which we have to get to. So he says, we'll have to fight our way through. And St. Mary Glees, we had to fight almost to get through it to go to Carrington. So we just about had to take St. Mary Glees.
And how did that work? How did you experience that?
Well, I was next to a guy. He was pointing his gun at this German, but the German shot first, and he killed this kid next to me. And I got it in my head. You better be faster than that German, because if you don't, you're dead.
Uh-huh.
So from then on, I was a little faster.
Yeah.
And that's how I survived. I figured, well, either you kill him or he kills you. You don't want to die, so you have to kill him.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned St. Mary Glees, and that, of course, is quite the tourist destination now. You were just there for the 70th anniversary a couple of years ago, and and you know how popular a spot that is. That was a key moment in this breakout. And the thing that everybody always talks about there is the parachute that's still hanging on the steeple of the church there.
The funny thing about that, John Steele was his name. And when he landed on this side. There's no street because it's facing the street is here and the church is right here next to it, going lengthwise the same way as the street.
And did you see the parachute hanging there in 1944?
Yeah.
You saw him up there.
Wait a minute now. Anyhow, he landed and he slid on it on this one side of the church.
Uh-huh.
He's down about 10, 15 feet from the peak of the roof. And we saw him up there. Didn't think nothing about it. We kept fighting. We got to get him off of there, you know. But we couldn't get near him. But the funny part of it was they didn't, the people in France said, this is the wrong side of the church. Put him on the other side where the street is so that people can see him up there. Yeah, that's what they did. They moved the parachute and him all across the other side of the church.
And for people who don't know the rest of the story, he did survive. The Germans may have thought he was dead up there.
Well, the story goes, he was up there and he's hanging there. He's just over the edge of the roof and he's wanting to get away from this parachute hanging there. So he took out a jump knife and he's cutting out this harness because it jammed or something. He couldn't get it loose.
Mm-hmm.
And he's sawing away at it and the knife slipped out of his hand and fell to the ground. Well, there was a German right down there and the knife just went right in front of him and landed on the ground. And the German looked down at the knife. Looked up and he saw John. Pow! He shot John in the foot, but he only fired the one shot. So anyhow, the Germans eventually got John down. They got him down some way, I don't know. And they took him prisoner. Well, he got rescued, got him away from the Germans again.
Mm-hmm.
So then he came with us.
Yeah, it's quite the story. It's quite the amazing story. And what you're pointing out for the listeners is that if they go and visit today, while there is a parachute hanging there in tribute to John Steele, it's not hanging the way it was on June 6, 1944.
In the beginning.
Right. And that has been referred to famously as the longest day. How long of a day was that for you?
I really didn't pay any attention. Just a day.
No big deal.
No.
Even though you've never been in combat before.
No.
And this is the most legendary day of combat in world history.
It just didn't bother me that it was supposed to be the longest day.
Mm-hmm.
It just that it was a day.
And it had started for you at, what, 3, 4 in the morning, something like that?
Oh, about 4 or 5. After we landed and everything, we got together. It started getting very slightly starting to turn morning.
Mm-hmm. And at what point do you think you were finally able to rest?
Well, I don't really know. I never thought about it. We didn't rest all that day that I know of.
Were you scared?
No. For some reason, I was not scared. Just that I wasn't going to let that German kill me,
mm-hmm.
or any German. And at that time, while we was going from St. Mary Glees to go to Carrington, we would have conflicts with the Germans, and they had wood bullets.
Wood bullets?
Wooden bullets. Did you ever hear about that one?
I've heard some, yeah. Tell
there
us.
Were two colors. One was some red, some green. And I think that they were on a training mission. The one side had red, the other side had green. Maybe that's the way it was, unless they got mixed up. But there was two, and they were hollow. And some of the guys got hit with them, huh? And they kind of shattered right in your skin, you know. And I had four or five of each one. But I don't know, they disappeared someplace along the line.
Oh, you carried some for a long time?
Yeah.
A little souvenir?
Yeah, it was a souvenir.
Sure.
But I lost them someplace, I don't know.
All right, so you're making it sound like this is no big deal. But there's a reason that your company has been so celebrated. What is it that you take pride in being part of Easy Company, this band of brothers?
Just being a paratrooper for the 101st. That I liked.
What can you tell me about the other guys you served with? What were they made out of?
Oh, they were a whole bunch of Texans, and I was stationed with them.
Mm-hmm.
After a while, you're talking just like them.
Got a little drawl going?
Yeah. That was funny. People used to ask me, you from Texas? I said, no, I'm from Montana. They couldn't believe it.
And what about the days and weeks that followed D-Day? Because that's what everybody talks about. But I'm sure you had a lot more to survive and some other close calls.
Well, we fought a bunch of little towns between St. Mary Glees and Carrington.
Mm-hmm.
We had quite a battle. We lost quite a few guys.
How did you handle that?
Well, you just look at them and say, I'm sorry. I just hope I'm not the next one.
Mm-hmm.
But you just kept going.
And you told us that you weren't scared. You said you didn't know why.
Yeah.
Did you think, and there's no right answer except your answer to this. I've heard a lot of different takes on it. Did you ever feel that somebody was protecting you?
No, never thought about it.
Mm-hmm.
I was worried that maybe I wasn't going to make it, that's all.
What are some of the moments that you look back on now and you say, yeah, that could have been me. That was way too close.
Yeah, there's some of the times that I could have been.
Can you give us some examples of those?
No.
That come to mind?
I don't like to talk about that. You don't like having to shoot somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when some of them, the Wehrmacht, they're playing soldiers. They didn't want to fight.
Mm.
But they were pushed behind them. Mm-hmm. They had SS and everybody else and big-time officer and everything else telling them either you do or we do you.
Right.
That's what I understood from some of them, the prisoners we took.
Yeah, and so you actually interacted with them and got a feel for what was happening from the other side.
Yeah, a little bit. Not much, but they didn't want to talk about it either.
What was the hardest thing for you to deal with or get used to?
Fighting, having to protect yourself.
Was there anything that you found, maybe you stumbled across or maybe you developed that helped you get through day to day under those kind of circumstances?
You're very watchful. You look all around to make sure that you're going in the right direction and that nobody's pointing a gun at you.
Mm-hmm. And I don't want to move on from D-Day too quickly. I'm sure you've talked to a lot of people about it over the years and you've read and seen and heard a lot about it. But at the time, did you have any sense of whether this was a successful mission or a failure?
We had no idea because we didn't have that communication. We had, I think, maybe a radio. Somebody had one, maybe. But we really didn't know what was going on, except that we knew we had to get to Carrington and meet up with everybody else.
And when you look back on that now, and like I said, you were just there 2 years ago back at Normandy for the 70th anniversary. What strikes you now about that day and its significance? Is there an aspect of D-Day, that Normandy invasion, that impresses you or is eye-opening for you?
I never thought about it. When we got to Carrington, we didn't. See, Carrington's a little bit inland. Not much, but a little bit. We didn't know what was going on the beaches or nothing like that. We didn't know anything about that.
Mm-hmm.
We got to Carrington, and then we started fighting east.
But you know about it now. You know what happened.
Yeah, they did. A bunch of them didn't make it. But that's as far as I know about that. I wasn't scared about it.
Does it give you some pride or satisfaction to have been a part of what happened that day?
Yes, I am. I'm proud I was with the 101st. And able to fight with them.
And what was it like to go back there 70 years later? What were the things that you saw or did that stand out in your memory?
Well, I saw potholes that you could drive a Jeep in and you walk back 30 feet and you couldn't see it. The holes were that big and I heard, someone told me that there was ships out to sea. It was out there a ways that they could fire their cannon and hit these things that the Germans always had. Pillboxes.
All the pillboxes. So these are shells from the American battleships, Texas, that's right offshore that left these craters that are still there.
Some of them craters was just about from here to that wall, about 12, 14 feet across.
So that was eye-opening for you.
Yeah. They were close. They were like close to the pillbox, just one pillbox. And I didn't go in a pillbox or nothing. I just looked at the holes. There was about three or four big potholes where our cannon made them trying to get to that.
Yeah, those craters will continue to help tell the D-Day story for years and years to come. But there aren't too many of you men who jumped behind enemy lines that day still with us, and only a few of you from the famous Band of Brothers. So when you were back there for the 70th anniversary of D-Day, I have to imagine you were quite the celebrity. Can you tell me a little bit about that adventure you had and the way they treated you over there?
That was good.
Tell me about it. What happened?
Well, we went to the St. Mary Glees in a bus from the ship. I got on the ship as a Mero Journey, as a cruise ship. We got on it in Portugal, and it came around up there, followed the coast around into France, Germany, and England, and places like that. When we got to some port there in France, we got onto this bus, and we headed for St. Mary Glees. Well, St. Mary Glees just didn't look the same no more. There must have been 5,000, 10,000, 15,000 more homes and everything built around it. And he was amazed at how big it got.
Mm-hmm.
And the people, it was a tourist town. And this one street must have had 3,000 people on it. And that's the way we had to go. Try to get through that 3,000 people to get to the museum. When we got in there, this guy had a Jeep, and on a bumper, you know, we always had our company painted on a bumper. Well, this one said 506 Parachute Infantry Regiment on it.
This Jeep that just happens to be driving through the streets of St. Mary Glees 70 years later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're talking to him, and he says, could I have you autograph something for me? I said, yeah. He says, and he handed me this Thompson submachine gun. So I signed it, you know, I put 506 on it and everything.
Yeah.
My company and everything on it. Then some guy walks up with another one, and I had to sign that one. Well, this guy that owned the Jeep says, autograph my hood. So I autographed the hood.
Uh-huh.
After we went through the museum, one part of the museum. We never got to the other parts. There's a Sherman tank there, and inside this building is a C-47 and a bunch of stuff, guns, ammunition, motors, just and vehicles and everything imaginable in there. So anyhow, we're on the way back, and we have to get to where the bus is. And we couldn't get through, so this guy says, I'll get you through, hop on my Jeep. And it was the same kind of Jeep with 506 on the bumper, and I autographed it. And as I sat in the dummy seat, you know, the captain of this cruise ship was with us, so he jumped up behind me. I got a picture of it up there.
Mm-hmm. I see the crowd around you.
Yeah. Well, right directly behind me, that's our captain of the ship. He got us through, and somebody, there was about two or three guys, and we're trying to move, and these guys are standing there, and they said, no, you don't go through it till you sign this gun. And so they come on the bus, and I signed it, and then they moved to one side. We got a little ways, and it was taking too long, and the little gal that does the commentator on the bus, near the this point is such and such. This point there. This is one of our attractions over here. That's an attraction over there. Somebody says, well, we have to get back to the ship. Just about that time, a police car is in front of us. So she run out, and she's talking to him. And first thing you know, she's back in the bus, and the police got us right in front of us.
Mm-hmm.
Got the siren going and everything, and they got us to the freeway. No problem. People just spread out and let us through.
You received quite the royal treatment over there.
Uh-huh. Shaking hands, taking pictures, getting kissed on the cheek and everything imaginable. Oh, about 200-300 times, you know, one way or another.
It's break time again, but don't forget to find photos of Mr. Ochsner at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. When we come back, this surviving member of the Band of Brothers remembers the Battle of the Bulge and the unthinkable scene he witnessed at a concentration camp. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Loeffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 94-year-old Henry Len Ochsner of California City, California. He's originally from Montana, and he's one of the last surviving members of Easy Company of the 101st Airborne's 506th Parachute Infantry Regiment, the unit celebrated by author Stephen Ambrose as the Band of Brothers. From France on D-Day to the Operation Market Garden Jump in Holland to the brutal moments in the Battle of the Bulge when the unit was surrounded, Mr. Ochsner lived through all of it, and some of it is still too much to talk about. But he's given us a little glimpse of that history he lived, and many of those memories became fresh again in 2014 when he returned to Normandy for the 70th anniversary of D-Day. The presidents of France and the U.S. were there, of course, and Mr. Ochsner also received a special gift from the mayor of the French town where he landed all those years ago, St. Mère Eglise.
I got a bronze medallion from him.
Did you get a sense of how the French people felt about you and what you had done?
They can't do enough for you. They loved you. They have a thing going, I don't know. I was told that the cemetery there, that every family has one tombstone and the area there, that they keep that area clean, mowed, and flowers on it all the time.
So the French people are tending to the graves of the American servicemen who died.
Uh-huh.
What was it like for you to see those cemeteries, to see all those crosses and those graves?
There was a bunch of them. And there was, four or five American GIs there. They found out that I was from the 506. And they're running all over this crowd, this graveyard, hunting for 506 on tombstones.
Mm.
And they'd find one, and they'd holler, and here's one, you know. And I'd go looking, and no, I didn't know him, you know. But there were so many of us, you haven't got a chance to really get down and be close friends with anybody.
Sure.
And sometimes it was a good thing not to be.
Absolutely. And the other thing that comes to mind for me is you described that first instance after you're on the ground in France and the guy next to you gets shot and you realize you're going to have to be fast and shoot them before they shoot you.
Uh-huh.
When you were back there 70 years later, did you ever consider what if? I mean, if one of those had gotten you, you never would have met your wife. Your four daughters would have never been born.
That's right.
No grandchildren. I mean,
I wouldn't be where I am. I wouldn't be alive.
Yeah. How do you explain all that?
You can't explain it. Leastways, I can't.
And we're just talking about your first battle. Uh-huh. You had another jump not long after in Holland.
Yeah.
Market Garden.
We was out of Carondare some distance and everything. And somebody says, we have to go back to England. So we went back to England, and they gave us some more training. And then they loaded us back in another bunch of airplanes and flew over Holland area. Nijmegen, and I landed in a little town called Zon, Z-O-N. But the Americans called it Sun, S-O-N. But that's where I landed, Market Garden. And then we fought Market Garden. Then we fought Hell's Highway. But on Hell's Highway, we were supposed to leapfrog with the British. We would jump them, and then they would jump us, you know, going down Hell's Highway. One time they didn't show up to go around over us, and we found out that it stopped for tea. That was kind of funny.
Is there something you think people need to know about those battles, that time in your service over there?
Just hope there's never another one.
Hmm. Well, there would be another big one for you, the Battle of the Bulge. You were in the worst part of it, in Bastogne.
As we were going down Hell's Highway, right around that area, we were bivouacked someplace there. We got word that we had to load up and go someplace. But they didn't tell us where. And they said, okay, we got all these vehicles. You get in this one, you get in that one, you get in that one. And I wound up in an army duck. And that was my transportation. So we traveled quite a while. Then we came to this town, and we found out it was Bastogne. We got set up in there. Then we find out, the Germans, when they'd fired their M88s at us, that was a dangerous weapon. Very accurate.
Mm-hmm.
They were good at it. They would fire these 88s, and we was in a forest. When it hit the ground, you know how shell goes up like that?
Mm-hmm.
About 45 degrees, something like that. They found out it wasn't very effective. We found out that they made it for whatever it hit, it exploded. So they made it where if it hit a tree, it would rain down on you.
The tree burst, yeah.
Yeah. Me and about four others dug this hole in the ground about from here to there, nine feet across and about 4 feet deep. And then we took and cut down about six trees. There was some laying there. And then we cut down maybe three or four. We laid it across the top of it from the dirt that was in there. We put it around it, and we put the trees on top of it across like that. Then we put our shelter halves, our tent halves,
mm-hmm.
on top of that. And whatever dirt we could find then, we threw on top of that. That way we had a chance.
Because otherwise, what you're saying is, if you're just camped out at the base of a tree, one of these 88s is going to hit the tree, and that shrapnel is going to come everywhere and could kill you while you're sleeping, or you're just taking shelter.
Yeah. But since we had this hole in the ground.
Yeah, probably saved your life.
Probably.
But I understand an 88 shell came even closer to you than that.
Yeah. They made me a Jeep driver for this lieutenant. And I was assigned a Jeep, and of course on a front bumper, 506, you know. But this Jeep, it was assigned to me. It was so cold. We had oil in that car, that Jeep. It got hard, it got stiff.
Mm-hmm.
And in the mornings, it hardly wouldn't start. You'd almost have to build a fire under it in order to get it warm enough to start, you know.
This was the coldest winter they said they'd ever had, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They said it was the worst one they had in 50 years.
Uh-huh.
So anyhow, I'm sitting in there, and I'm trying to turn this. I'm turning the starter on, and it's going, and I don't think it's going to start, you know. And I was talking to them. There was this other guy, this other GI. He said, oh. He said, come on, quick. He says, into the barracks there. And there was a building. There was something like 60 feet wide and about 90 feet long.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about 40 feet high inside. And on the end of it had that swastika, the eagle or the whatever, the bird.
Yep.
And then they had that thing on the bottom with the swastika on it.
Right.
It was up on that wall, way up high. So I jumped out of the Jeep and I run for the building. And we dove into the building. And as I dove into the building, this 88 landed right next to my Jeep. And it put shrapnel all over the poor thing. Got the radiator and everything imaginable. It got one little piece of shrapnel. It was about that big. And it went through my boot right here.
Uh-huh.
And got my heel. So what happened? I just take off my boot, reached in my pocket, got a Band-Aid.
Uh-huh.
And went back to usual. Went out and looked at my Jeep. It wasn't drivable no more. And so they assigned me back to my company. And we went out to a town called Foy, and it's closer to the Germans.
Mm-hmm.
You could almost see them. And we had to fight with them, you know.
Well, and with that incident with your Jeep, I mean, I'm just thinking, if you wait a split second longer
to get out
of there.
If it hadn't been for that guy I was talking to.
Yeah.
He counts them. He was counting the incoming. And they say, when you don't hear one coming, that's yours.
Right.
It's got your name on it.
Yeah, and it did have your name on it.
Did have.
And if you would have waited another half second, it would have gotten more than just your heel.
That's right. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Probably sawed off a couple of legs or something.
Whew. You ever look back on all this and have a hard time understanding or believing all of it, that you survived all of that?
I never much thought about it. It just kind of...
Just the way it is?
Yeah.
All right.
Just before they assigned me the Jeep, I was standing guard at this... It's either a church or a monastery. I don't remember what it was. I never knew what it was. But I was standing there at this door, and I'm the guard. I don't know why. I'm the guard. And just inside the door, there's steps going down, about 14 steps, 18 steps, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You wound up going down about 9 feet below the ground level. And I'm starting to count these things now because of him.
Sure.
So you can count those 88s, you know. You count 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4.
You're just timing the separation between the shells?
and you count to four and you don't hear one. It's got your name. I turned around, I dove down the these stairs, and I slid down on my belly. And down at the bottom, there was an aisleway about from here to the TV wall, wide. And I slid about halfway across it. And about that time, here comes this 88 down there, and it poked his head out. It was sticking out about that far. And I'm laying there on this ground. I'm on my belly, and I'm looking at this thing. And I'm waiting for it to blow. It never did.
Wow.
Yeah, that was another incident.
Yeah, it's about as close as you can come right there.
That's the closest I ever came. Just looking at that 88 sticking out of the wall.
And I always wonder in something like that if it was sabotage, if it was, you know, some of the people, slave labor that...
People doing that, they were doing that.
Uh-huh.
They were sabotaging their own ammunition. Then there was an incident where a rail car gun, I guess that son of a gun was something like 18 feet long or something like that.
Huge, 20 feet gun.
Long, you know?
Yeah.
And it's on this flatbed rail made special for it to sit on.
Mm-hmm.
And you could hear it, hear them fire it back there about 8 miles. Boom. Then pretty soon, it was so big around and not long enough that it started cartwheeling and it sounded like a freight train coming. Well, when it hit Best Stone, it went through about four buildings and landed in the middle of the street and blew up in the middle of the street. And it left a hole pretty close to 16 feet wide and about 8-9 feet deep.
And you saw that happen, or you just heard it coming over?
Oh, we heard it coming over.
Yeah.
And then we heard the explosion.
And then you went and saw the aftermath.
Yeah. And we called that old number 10 freight train.
I guess so. Glad you weren't in its way. I need to ask you about the Honor Flight. I'm here because Lily told me about you from Honor Flight Kern County. What was it like for you to go back to Washington, D.C. and see all of that?
Quite emotional. I took some pictures of it, and they got a wall. It's concave like that, and it's filled with stars. And then there's a caption that says, each star represents 100 killed soldiers.
In World War II. Yep. 406,000 Americans. And you've just given us examples of how close you came to being one of them.
Yeah, being one of them stars.
So looking at that wall got to you?
No, I just looked at it and said, oh, my God. Then we went to the Vietnam Wall.
Mm-hmm.
We went to about three or four of them. And the guy that was my guardian, he was a top sergeant in the Army. His name was Michael Alden. He took me over to a grave. He said, now here's a man I like. It was Audie Murphy's grave.
At Arlington, yeah.
Yeah.
What was the most meaningful part of that whole experience? Because you see a lot there. You do a lot. They welcome you home. They write you letters. I mean, there's a lot of different aspects of this Honor Flight experience. What was the most meaningful for you?
Just being there. And I looked for different pillars in different states and everything, one for every state. I found California, and it was a very emotional experience.
Is that encouraging to know that people understand how significant what you guys did really is still today?
Some people appreciate it. Others don't even know there was a war.
Well, that's why we need guys like you to tell us about it, like you've done today.
What about Berchtesgaden?
Yeah, were you there?
I was in Berchtesgaden.
What'd you see?
I saw some SS. We went and got SS out of the woods to find out if they were SS. We figured most of them that we ever got out of the forest up there around the eagle's nest, we'd make them strip to the waist and do this.
Mm-hmm.
And right under here, on the bottom side of the arm, you can see two jags of lightning.
That was the SS.
SS. Uh-huh. With their serial number. And that's how we used to know.
On the underside of their arm, they had that tattooed on there.
Uh-huh. But a lot of them had doctors try to take it out of there. But you can still tell it. We had quite a few. But the Eagle's Nest, that was Hitler's hideout. You know, he used to go up there, him and Eva Braun. I guess he married her just before they committed suicide, I guess.
Right.
There was a tunnel you go to get into Hitler's hideout. And I guess when they fired on this place up there, they never hit the building. But they always seemed to hit right around that tunnel where they go down the tunnel. The rocks and everything from the explosions of the shells kind of ruined the tunnel.
Well, you've experienced a lot of history, sir.
I'm glad that I was able to do it.
I guess the other thing I didn't ask you about, there aren't too many people left who can say this, but you saw firsthand the horrors of a concentration camp.
Yeah, we were going down the road. I don't remember where we were headed, but we came out of this forest, and here's this fenced area with people. See, all one kind of uniform, striped, you know. The gate was shut, and it was locked. Our captain went to there to go in, but he couldn't because of the lock. And somebody got the lock or the chain off, I don't know. He went in, and there was bodies stacked as high as that television set. Just stacked. And that stack was something like maybe 15, 20 feet long. And these people that were still alive were so skinny, they were nothing but just plain skin and bones. And how they survived, I'll never figure it out. I guess they had the guts enough to survive. But it was nothing but bones and skin. No meat. No meat on them to speak of. And we started giving them our K rations and C rations and stuff like that. And the water and everything. Our officer told us, don't feed them too much because it'll kill them. Because they're not used to this. We slowed down, but we still fed a whole bunch of them, you know.
How difficult was that to see?
That was horrible. A horrible thing to see.
When you think back on that now, is there some satisfaction knowing that you guys got there when you did and that those people who were still alive?
And survived, yeah. And they survived on account of us being there. Otherwise, they'd have probably... There was people sitting on the ground and they were dying. People laying on the ground dying. Some were just hanging on the fence trying to stay alive. It was a horrible thing to see.
I'm sure you've got many more stories where that came from. I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country.
You're welcome. Thank you
for telling us what you've shared with us. I know it's not easy to talk about some of it, but it helps us understand the price that's been paid for our freedom. Is there something that you would say that you're most proud of or most thankful for?
I'm thankful that we did it, even though it was a horrible thing to do, but it was something that had to be done. Not just 101st. I mean, every branch of the service.
Mm-hmm.
If it hadn't been for one another, I think we'd have still been talking German on the East Coast and Japanese on the West Coast.
Mm-hmm. One last question I have to ask you, because I know that you and Violet have been married for 70 years. Not many people can say that. How'd you pull that off? What's your secret?
Just do what each other's supposed to do. If one says do this, both of you do it. If you had an argument in the daytime, regardless of what kind of an argument you had, when you go to bed, you kiss goodnight. That erased the arguments.
She's nodding her head. That's a good sign.
And if you'd like to see a photo of just how happy Len and Violet are after 70 years of marriage, pull up the Hometown Heroes Facebook page on Facebook or go to hometownheroesradio.com. Thanks again to Honor Flight Kern County and Lily Marsh for connecting me to the Oshners. They also made it possible for Len to go up in a C-47 again at age 94. Some pretty incredible history that this man has lived through, and what a privilege to share some of it with you. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.